This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
We also have Anthony Chabaderwe.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
So this is our first week in review program of 2018, and I wanted to start with a bit of a look ahead, being part of the Trumpet staff and assessing world events in light of biblical prophecy. It's just getting more and more amazing and exciting as times grow more urgent. We do find closer and closer alignment between forecasts we've been making for decades and what we see happening around us. So much so that more and more analysts are pointing to the same trends that we focus our attention on, and they're saying, well, this is really what you need to be watching. Richard guest hosted this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and he looked at one assessment of the big risks, the big stories that face the world in 2018 from a firm called Eurasia Group, and he showed just how closely what they foresee in the time ahead aligns with biblical prophecy. This is just one example of people who are looking ahead and projecting what the world might look like this coming year. But I just wanted to start the program by giving him a few minutes to give this big picture view of the world. Take it away, Richard.
So the first thing that really stands out from the Eurasia Group piece is just how dramatic they see 2018 being. Mm-hmm. They talked about how it basically looked like the most unstable in their history of existing as a company over the last 20 years. They said basically what they expect for 2018 is the geopolitical equivalent of the 2008 financial crisis. Mm-hmm. So not an economic crisis, but just kind of like this world-shaking political crisis, which of course is exactly the kind of thing that we expect in the imminent future. So just that approach alone was very striking.
They really used a lot of language that was unprecedented. This, and you know, we do see that not just from this group, as you brought out, but from a lot of people, those who are forecasting risks and those who are just assessing what's going on. That we've just never seen anything quite like what we see happening in the world today.
That's right. And the way they put it was basically, look, we all kind of feel like 2008 is going to be a bad year. What we're doing in our report is we want to try and put some specifics down. Mm-hmm. They're articulating a feeling that a lot of people have. So in terms of their specifics, they kind of had a video where they had a top 10 countdown that I used on the program. One thing they talked about is Africa's security. And as I talked about in the program, you know, we've been talking about that for several years. There was an article from 2013 where Mr. Gerald Flurry just basically almost exactly said, watch Africa, watch radical Islam in Africa. Mm-hmm. You're going to see a clash building between radical Islam and Europe in North Africa. And we've seen that already. And he says, well, just watch for that to really intensify and spread to other nations over the next year. The UK, they pointed to the decline of the UK, the lack of trust in institutions. Quite a lot of these trends tied into, I thought, our recent strongman issue of the Trumpet, like the rise of nationalism in Asia, the erosion of institutions where people are looking more to strongmen. There's more division rather than kind of robust liberal democratic institutions. He talked about Iran, and obviously, I think that's got to be on anyone's threat list, on Mexico and declining ties between the U.S. and Mexico. There's the very real prospect you'll have quite an anti-American Mexican president coming up in the next year. They're just right next door to America, so you've got a lot of potential for danger to America there. A lot of global tech cold war, with just more and more of hacking and cyber warfare being more and more in the news. That's something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry was pointing to back in the early 90s, before most people even had the internet. Mm-hmm. But that's something that's becoming more and more of a news. Just even, he calls it accidents. What he's really talking about, I think, is just unexpected events. Just the whole climate of instability is so high that something unexpected could probably happen from one of those.
Like a 9/11 China scale type event.
Yeah, exactly. And then China was the big one that they pointed to as the number one risk there, with China just not only rising militarily, but just challenging the United States for global leadership now, almost openly in some cases, putting forward just an alternative model to America's liberal democracy and really making a bid for leadership of global trade and just to be the leader of the world, the leading global power. And that just this vacuum, and one of the overall things that came across was with the vacuum of the United States, the world is a much more unstable place, and you've got more powers now competing to try and fill that vacuum.
Right. That really does stand out from the, you know, this is something that we've talked a lot about, the post-American world and entering into what the Bible terms the times of the Gentiles. You know, it's a good list, the things that they pinpointed. What also struck me was the fact that they view Europe as basically a black hole. They don't see that as having any kind of posing any kind of risk. And maybe 2018 it doesn't. I mean, I suppose if you're looking at it in the short term, there's still so many things that Europe has to work out. But they're not even looking. They didn't even mention, say, the political shift that's taking place in several European countries. We'll talk more about some of that a little bit later in the program. But this is one area where having the understanding that we have because of biblical prophecy really helps us to see things in clearer terms than even a risk assessment group like this.
Yes, yeah, that's right. They did actually, outside of their top 10 in the report, they did mention Europe. And basically, their conclusion was that Europe still has major long-term challenges, but that these probably won't come to a head in 2018.
Yeah.
So and there might be something to that. I think with Bible prophecy, I think we'd say it's a lot more imminent than that. But even just this blind spot to Europe is something that's prophesied. You know, yeah. The Bible talks about Europe America viewing these European powers as their lovers, as kind of just it being unimaginable that there could be any threat from that quarter. So in some ways, even that omission is a reflection of Bible prophecy.
Very interesting. Well, I would encourage you, if you didn't hear Richard's program, I think it's definitely worth listening to. Maybe that would be something we could write up. I watched that, read that article, I guess, from the Eurasia Group earlier in the week and thought that this really would make a good article just comparing some of these things. And there you took that on the program this morning. But it is really fascinating to compare and contrast, say, the view of this group with what we've been talking about so much on the trumpet. So we appreciate that, Richard. The top threat, according to that group, was China. We're going to go now to Asia and look at what China's been up to. One of its dangerous activities has been the way that it's propping up North Korea. This is really unmistakable evidence of just how much China wants to undermine America and use North Korea in order to further its own ambitions. To talk about the latest evidence of what it's been up to and also of Russia helping in this same dangerous activity, we're going to turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China has been caught making illegal oil shipments to North Korea. We have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's by Callum Wood, and it's called China Caught Selling Oil to North Korea. And this article talks about reconnaissance satellite images recently released by the U.S. Treasury Department. And these images show what is almost certainly a Chinese ship transferring oil at sea to a North Korean vessel. And then the Treasury Department has imagery, they say, proving that there have been at least 30 of these ship-to-ship transfers involving Chinese vessels since October. And then in a separate report, Reuters reported on December 29th that Russian tankers have also been supplying fuel to North Korea by this same method, which is transferring cargoes at sea rather than bringing the ship all the way to port, which would be easier for the international community to monitor. And for Russia, there have been 3 documented instances of this activity, which took place in October and in November.
So this is blatantly violating international law, sanctions against North Korea. I mean, it really shows just how meaningless that law is, doesn't it?
That's right. And in both the case of Russia and in China, these transfers are in clear breach of international law and in clear breach of specific United Nations sanctions that they signed on to. Back on September 11th of last year, just after North Korea had conducted its sixth nuclear test. Both Russia and China voted to pass UN Security Council Resolution 2375. And this resolution was fairly weak, but it did set clear limits on numerous kinds of energy exports to North Korea. And it also specifically banned ship-to-ship transfers of energy to North Korea. So both Moscow and Beijing signed on to these UN measures, but now both of them have been caught in clear violation of those very sanctions. So it really looks like, you know, Richard mentioned China's strategy of even directly and openly challenging America and presenting themselves as an alternative to the US-led system. And I think that part of that strategy is Beijing wants the world to sort of think that they're trying to contain the North Korean threat. They make a lot of overtures about that. But in actual practice, they have no intention of doing that. And it's the same situation with Russia.
So there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of attention focused on North Korea and the threat from North Korea. But in a lot of ways, this backs up what Gerald Fleury's been saying and what biblical prophecy tells us, that the bigger threat, the much bigger threat, even like this Eurasia group determined, is from China. I mean, China is the one that is enabling this to happen. Russia is the one enabling this to happen. Russia and China together, really, that's where we need to be focusing our attention, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Much of the world seems to be fixated on North Korea because there's a lot of bluster coming from the peninsula there, from Kim Jong-un. But Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has recently said that it is, you know, it's Russia and China that the world should be much more concerned about than North Korea. And that's in part because Russia and China are the ones who let North Korea's leaders behave the way they do. And Mr. Fleury explained that his read on this situation is based on Bible prophecy. It was a September 13th message. He said, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." Yeah. And the Bible prophecies that Mr. Fleury is referring to there can be found mainly in the book of Revelation and in Jeremiah and also in Ezekiel and Daniel. And these chapters show that Russia will very soon lead a powerful military bloc, and China will be in a really powerful position within that bloc. And the prophecies show that several smaller Asian nations, very likely including North Korea, will be grafted into that Russia-led block, and their military power will be absorbed into it. But the scriptures show that North Korea would not be a major player in that grouping.
Right. Yeah. So for more information, where would you send people?
I would send them to Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. This is a very powerful booklet that just talks about the way Russia and China to a lesser degree are really just driving events, and even how their interaction with North Korea is leading the world toward war.
All right. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Turning now to the Middle East, protests in Iran have been going on for about a week now. Quite a lot of anger against the country's religious leaders. American leaders are saying they support this uprising, but there's really no evidence that that support's going to go beyond words and tweets. For this story, we're going to go to Anthony Chibadewe.
Yes, the protests have began on December 28th, so that's a little over a week ago. And as you rightly said, they are dissipating, unfortunately. The protesters, they started off demonstrating against the rising costs of basic food staples. Some food staples have gone up 700%. The overall inflation in the country has been around 10%. And unemployment in Iran stands at around 12%. And among the youth, it's about 20%. Things have not been well in Iran. One in three people lives in a slum. And a BBC investigation found that Iranians are 15% poorer today than they were 10 years ago. But one important thing to note from this is that Iranians are not going on the streets now, because the Iranian leaders have suddenly become evil now. No, that's not the case. the Iranian regime has oppressed its people and exported terrorism beyond its borders. This has been a known fact for years. Iranians have been on the streets before. In 2009, they were protesting against election fraud. But those demonstrations were stopped by the Iranian regime, just like these recent demonstrations have been stopped. So it's not like they were protesting against a sudden evil that just emerged. It's just that the actions of the Iranian regime have just severely impacted the Iranian people to a point where they felt like they just needed to express themselves. And as you said, tweets and just statements from the United States administration, they're not going to help out. In fact, one thing that actually works against President Trump is that even the ordinary Iranians, they don't support President Trump. You might remember that President Trump has imposed travel bans on Iran, on Iranians, and it's good to have those travel bans, but the ordinary Iranian is not going to be excited about what President Trump says. And another thing is that President Trump in October refused to certify Iranian compliance with the nuclear deal. Now, the ordinary Iranian might know that Iran is not complying with the nuclear deal, but the problem is that the rest of the world opposed President Trump for this. And the narrative that the world has been sending out there to Iranians is that President Trump shouldn't have decertified the nuclear deal because we need to appease Iran's leaders and we need to boost the economy, increase trade, which should in turn help the ordinary Iranian, which is a false narrative. But with all those factors at play, you don't expect Iranians to go on board with President Trump. And another problem is that America has a sad history of half-hearted efforts in supporting revolutions and effecting regime change in the Middle East. You can take a look at Afghanistan, you can take a look at Iraq, at Syria, at Kurdistan. You can even go back 30 years ago when America encouraged the Kurds to revolt against Saddam Hussein. America turned its back on the Kurds, and Saddam gassed thousands of the Kurds. Back then, when that happened, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury called it the greatest betrayal in U.S. history. And he was right, and I'm sure a lot of Iranians remember that history. So we don't expect much to come out of these protests. In fact, they've essentially dissipated. The Iranians are still strong. They're still accusing the United States of causing all these problems. So not much to expect from that.
Yeah, I think if anything, just the way that the Iranian regime has conducted its business since the nuclear deal was struck just shows how determined they are to pursue this strategy that they've been pursuing, funding terrorist activities throughout the region, doing whatever they can to extend their dominance. A few protesters in the streets, and this is considerably smaller than it was back in 2009, the Green Revolution, which they also successfully squashed. This isn't going to derail them at all. But you do see, I think Richard made this point this morning, that It is the regimes that are strongest, most forceful in strong-arming their people that stick around. It's the ones that are maybe a little bit weaker, or they don't have quite the iron will to put down a protest like this, that they're the ones that end up getting toppled. But you look at Syria, this going on for I don't know how many years now, that Assad is still in power despite doing things that are far worse than what you've seen in Iran in terms of suppressing their own people. This regime isn't going anywhere. If you did want to point people to prophecies that would show what we can expect in the time ahead for Iran, what would you point people to, Anthony?
One booklet that I would point to is The King of the South. It's a booklet by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, and it goes through all the Bible prophecies that discuss Iran and its activities right now, the violence that it's exporting all over the world, that's prophesied in the Bible. And the Bible also prophesied what should happen in the next few years. The Bible talks about regime change in Iran, but it's not going to come at the hands of Iranians in the streets, demonstrating in the streets. It's going to come from a foreign power, and we have all of that information in that booklet, The King of the South.
All right, thanks for that, Anthony. You can find that booklet on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. We'll also put the link to that, as well as the other articles that we've been talking about, in the show notes for the program today. If you just go to the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Fresh interest in how the Middle East peace process is going to be handled after Donald Trump announced that America recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital, particularly because many people felt this eliminated the U.S. as an objective mediator. The Pope inserted himself into this discussion in his Christmas Day address. He has his view on behalf of the Catholic Church. This is certainly an important voice, not just representing a religious view, but also a European view. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, during both his Christmas Eve and Christmas Day address, Pope Francis talked about lessons that he thinks we can learn from the birth of Jesus on how to bring peace to the Middle East. And one thing a lot of analysts haven't picked up on, though, is when you compare his Christmas Eve with his Christmas Day message, there's actually a double standard there that is making problems much worse in this region. And I guess to show you what I mean is, in his Christmas Eve message, he focused mainly on how the birth of Christ shows that we're supposed to welcome foreigners into our land with open arms, because Christ was a foreigner coming into Bethlehem, and no one would give him room at the inn because he wasn't from there. And then during his Christmas Day message, he focused on how the birth of Christ shows how we need a two-state solution, because the tension between Israeli and Palestinian is similar to the tensions between the Jews and King Herod, and asked that everyone needs to be praying for secure, internationally recognized borders in these two states he's proposing in the Middle East. And that's the first time I've actually heard, well, I've heard him say this before, but this is the only instance where I've heard Pope Francis really speak much in favor of borders. But that's normally, in the United States, he's very much for, we need to let
walls are unchristian.
Walls are unchristian. In one of his ecumenicals, he's talked about, he said, I'm the leader of the universal church. I don't really like borders. He's criticized America for not letting in more Hispanic immigrants. He's criticized Europe for not letting in more Middle Eastern Syrian immigrants. But when it comes to Israel, apparently he's all for, we need two states, we need two borders. We shouldn't be immigrants between the two. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of gets to the heart of this issue, as Melanie Phillips, when she was on our campus earlier this year, had brought out, is in Israel, the so-called Jewish state, 20% of the citizens are Arabs, and the citizens, at least, have the same rights as anyone else. Mm-hmm. The people living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they're not citizens. That's kind of territory in limbo after the Six-Day War. But the leaders of those, of the Palestinian Authority, have been very vocal. They don't want one single Jew in Palestinian territory. And so you see real quickly that a two-state solution under current conditions is going to be a Jewish state with a thriving ethnic Arab minority, and an Arab state that's been ethnically cleansed of all Jewish presence. Mm-hmm. And so when the Pope starts talking about, like, well, I'm for immigrants, but I want a two-state solution, you're like, well, first of all, you can't absolutely be for both those things at the same time. And secondly, by elevating the Palestinians to an equal partner in this, even though they're not accepting Jews in their territory, is you're bringing this whole situation closer to a time that the adult Jesus talked about. He talked a lot about the baby Jesus and how he teaches people to be accepting of immigrants. But the adult Jesus and his Olivet prophecy was saying that one of the signs of the end time is going to be Jerusalem's going to be trodden underfoot by the Gentiles. And he even references the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And then you go to Daniel the prophet in the Old Testament, and he's really explicit in Daniel 11 about there's going to be a king of the north, and there's going to be a king of the south, and the king of the south is going to push at the king of the north. The king of the north is going to come against him like a whirlwind and then enter into the Holy Land. Mm-hmm. And when that northern armies surround Jerusalem, that's the sign that the abomination of desolation is here. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that the kind of the behind-the-scenes reason the Pope is for all this is since 2000, actually, the Vatican signed an agreement with the Palestinians to turn Jerusalem into an international city. I'm not sure if the Palestinians, if that's still their end goal or not, but that's definitely the Vatican's end goal, is that they don't want it ruled by Jews, they don't want it ruled by Arabs, they want it ruled by some international body, probably composed mostly of European nations with close ties to the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so he can push this, supporting the Palestinians, to get his international city, and even use stories about Christ's birth to show how we should have a two-state solution somehow. But he's completely ignored the fact that as an adult, Jesus gave an entire sermon on how the sign of his second coming was going to be Jerusalem falling to a Gentile power.
Well, we have an article on thetrumpet.com called Why Does the Pope Insist on a Two-State Solution in Israel? You can find that. It's a Kieran Underwood article about this determination the Vatican has to make Jerusalem an international city. We've actually been writing about this for quite some time because of the prophecies that Andrew was referring to there. You can also look at our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, which gives the overview of what we can expect to have happen in that city in the time ahead. Certainly something to keep our eyes on. And after that Trump announcement, you can definitely foresee this being much more headline-making event over this this coming year. There's going to be a lot more pressure put on looking for a quote-unquote solution to the issue of what happens in that city. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a reconciliation between Germany and Turkey. Turkey's rise as a military power, Japan's rise as a military power, also some reports on crime, one from Germany, the other from Baltimore. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Relations between Germany and Turkey have been strained for a long time. These two countries obviously have major differences, irreconcilable differences, yet in many ways they also need each other. In a recent address, Turkey's strongman leader emphasized how much he wants good relations with Europe. It's a trend we watch closely because of some very specific biblical prophecies about this relationship. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this has been really a fascinating about-face from Turkey. I mean, these two powers, Turkey and Germany, have had a massive fallout in 2017. You know, you had Turkey locking up German journalists or journalists who were dual citizens and Germans like protesting on the streets. There was a whole like, protest movement for one particular one of these Germans. Then you had Turkey barring German parliamentarians from visiting German troops on a Turkish airbase. And that blew up to the point that Germany just pulled all of its soldiers out of Turkey. There was a war of words going on at quite a high level with various different threats of recriminations and Turkey accusing the Germans of being Nazis, which is kind of ironic because Erdogan has also talked about how Hitler isn't quite so bad at times. But he was basically there calling Angela Merkel Nazis and all this kind of thing because of, various different tit-for-tat issues and the referendum Turkey had last year. So things looked really bleak. And kind of right at the bleakest, we had an article in the Trumpet Print saying, watch these two because they're going to become allies. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing major steps in that already. Like you said, he's said how they desire good relations with the EU and Turkey, and Turkey's foreign minister are now talking about how the two are trying to normalize relations. Kristen Brackel, head of the Heinrich Boll Foundation in Istanbul, he talked about how the two are working on a quiet rapprochement. Deutsche Welle was talking about this. It's something that's coming across now a lot in the news. So you're seeing, and you had the former German chancellor, he traveled to Turkey at the end of September in kind of a discreet mission to meet with Erdogan. So this is something that's not just, something that's brand new with the start of the year, but it's certainly something that's gotten a lot more attention at the start of the year.
So give us an idea of why we are expecting this reconciliation between these two countries, prophetically speaking.
Mm-hmm. So with an understanding of history, you can gain a picture of some of what would happen. Germany and Turkey have historically often been close allies. If Germany is going to project power into the Middle East, Turkey's their preferred relation to do that. At the same time, Turkey generally needs a powerful external patron to enable it to stand up to a strong Russia that is always looking to drive right through Turkey on its way to a warm water port in the Mediterranean. So you've got some historic reasons, but then the Bible prophecy prophesies very specifically about a relationship between Europe and Turkey. It talks about this rising power in Europe. It makes clear that Turkey won't be part of that power.
Right.
But at the same time, the Bible talks about Turkey. Edom is Turkey in the Bible. And it talks about how this Edomite power, it's going to be allied with this European power. And then even in Psalm 83, which comes up a lot in this show, that lists several Middle Eastern powers that are all allied with Europe, Turkey is there right at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
So Bible prophecy was very specific that they're going to be allied with Europe. And a lot of people last year were saying, well, look, Turkey's going to now it's going to be allied with Russia. And you can see more. You can see now how that's already starting to turn around. And the Bible tells us very clearly that's going to keep turning around. We have an article from the November 2011 Trumpet Print that's called East, West, or Neither, that's probably the best place to go and just really prove Turkey's identity as Edom in the Bible. And then that article I mentioned that we published kind of at the height of some of these disagreements is called Pivotal Power from the October 2017 Trumpet Print Edition. We can make sure we put both of those links in the show notes.
Well, very good. We appreciate that, Richard. It's one of those situations that you definitely watch differently because of the understanding that we have based on prophecy. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to see that despite all of the issues that have surfaced between those two countries, probably especially since that 2016 failed coup in Turkey that just showed how much more of a dictator President Erdogan was becoming in Turkey, and how icky it is to kind of have relationships with him, in spite of there being such an important contributor to NATO and so on. But it continues to clip along, and you can see it, being prepared to fulfill those prophecies that you were talking about. Well, one thing that makes Germany uneasy is just how much Erdogan is increasing his personal power and taking on dictatorial powers. He's also aiming to increase Turkey's military might, and he's really making some bold moves in doing this. For this story, we're going to go back to Anthony Chabaterway.
The Turkey that Richard was talking about, the Turkey that's discussed in Bible prophecy for this end time, is a Turkey that's powerful militarily, and we are seeing a lot of developments towards that with the power that Erdogan is amassing to himself. Last week, Turkey passed emergency decree number 696, and that decree is viewed by many analysts as a step toward constructing a powerful and independent Turkish military. Emergency decree number 696 places Turkey's military procurement process under the direct authority of President Erdogan. It also places the Turkish Armed Forces Foundation under his direct control, and it permits Erdogan to appoint personnel to the procurement industry at his discretion. And it also reduces Turkey's dependence on foreign military purchases, and it really bolsters the Turkish military. Geopolitical Futures sent out a newsletter yesterday discussing this subject, and it reminded us, as you just did, about that failed coup against Erdogan in July 2016. And ever since that coup, Erdogan has been obsessed with the military, just wanting to be as involved as he possibly can in all military matters, and he's taking more direct control of the different aspects of how his military is going to work, and it's boosting his own power, and it's also boosting the power of Turkey. And Geopolitical Futures makes this comment. It says that Turkey feels its need to expand its military, and to do that, it needs to expand its territory, whether via proxies or otherwise. It needs to do that to create a buffer zone for its the core of Turkey from the chaos in the Middle East. And that point actually ties in with a lot of the trends that we're watching, because Turkey and Europe in general have been developing this relationship, especially with the migrant crisis, and it was primarily Europe's desire to have a buffer from all the chaos coming from the Middle East. And there are many other reasons, as we discussed, as Richard discussed, that this relationship would need to continue between Europe and Turkey. So we are seeing a lot of that building up, and it's starting a lot more with all these developments with Erdogan and boosting his military.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch that develop. We're going to tie that in with another somewhat related story. Turkey isn't the only nation increasing its military might. In fact, there are several countries that are responding to increasing threats in the world, like those we looked at the beginning of the program, by strengthening their armies, boosting their weaponry. Another of these countries is Japan. I talked with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about this on Wednesday's program. We're going to hear even more information about it now from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, 2017 really ended on a high note for Japan's march toward remilitarization. On December 26th, news broke that Japan is planning to retrofit its Izumo helicopter carriers so that they can carry U.S.-made F-35B warplanes. And that was major news because it means Japan will soon have its first fixed-wing aircraft carrier since the end of World War II. And then a couple of days before that, Japanese military authorities confirmed that they will soon equip Japan's own fleet of F-35A warplanes with long-range cruise missiles. These missiles would be capable of hitting targets as far as 550 miles away, and that'll mark Japan's first major purchase of, you know, overtly offensive weaponry in more than half a century. And then just a few days before that news, Japan's cabinet approved yet another record-setting defense budget. The budget for 2018 will grow to around $46 billion for Japan's military. So that breaks all the records by a considerable margin. So the Japanese really ended the year with some milestone moves toward militarization.
So this is a huge break for Japan. We talked about this on Wednesday's program, just how much they had been dominated by this, the pacifist constitution and the effort to kind of distance themselves from some of the belligerents in World War II. What is it that's driving Japan to shift into a higher gear with its militarization?
Well, there are three main reasons right now. The first is increasing fear of China. Japan is an island nation with very few resources, so it's dependent on maritime sea lanes in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea to be able to get all the oil and raw materials that it needs in order to function economically and militarily. And China right now is increasingly trying to take over those sea lanes, especially in the South China Sea, which we've discussed on numerous Trumpet Hour episodes in the past. So Japan feels very threatened even existentially threatened by China's increasing belligerence. And so the Japanese just feel that they need a full-fledged military in order to be able to prevent China from blocking them out of these vital sea lanes. Mm-hmm. And then the second reason is very much related, and that is that the United States is not viewed as reliable as it once was in terms of being a power that can safeguard the freedom of movement in the South China Sea and elsewhere. Tokyo has long relied on the U.S. for Japan's security and for just keeping those sea lanes navigable. But it now sees that America's security guarantee isn't worth what it once was. So Japan is preparing to step out from under America's security umbrella. And they know that to do that, they need to have a formidable military of their own.
So this is really a very specific fulfillment of what we were talking about at the very beginning. Say the Eurasia group, they're looking at the world and they're looking at how many ripple effects there are from America withdrawing as a leader in the world. Here you've got Japan stepping up and saying, well, we need to arm ourselves if we're going to be able to fulfill our defense needs in America's absence.
That's exactly right. Yes, the vacuum left by the U.S. there is prompting a lot of nations like Japan to want to arm a lot more. And then Japan is also very concerned, perhaps more so than anything else, about North Korea. Mm-hmm. The North is testing missiles and nuclear weapons with startling frequency, and those tests are often through Japanese airspace or otherwise very near to Japan. And just yesterday, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said North Korea poses the biggest threat that Japan has faced since World War II, back when Japan was decisively defeated. And it's kind of a strange statement because, of course, Japan was an aggressor in World War II. So the comparison's a little bit strange. But he said, quote, "It is not an exaggeration to say that the security environment surrounding Japan is at its severest since World War II. I will protect the people's lives and peaceful living in any situation." Mm-hmm. And then he went on to specifically name North Korea. And then I would also briefly add a fourth reason, which is just that many people in Japan, particularly the right wingers such as Shinzo Abe, are just tired of feeling guilty for World War II. Hmm. And they want Japan to have a normalized military. And now they have three very legitimate reasons to begin to normalize Japan's military.
So we spoke in the first half, and we were talking about just the real threat being from China and Russia and not from North Korea. You were talking about just how frosty the relationship between China and Japan is. Maybe you can just put this in prophetic context for us. We see this arms race developing within Asia. How does this fit into Bible prophecy?
Well, yes, right now it's a little bit difficult to see how Japan would lend its military might to this Russia-China-led end-time military bloc. But Bible prophecy does show, if you look in Ezekiel 38, verse 6, it says that Gomer and Togarma will be part of this Asian military bloc. And those are ancient names for the main people who make up modern Japan. So you can see how if America were removed from the equation, Japan would be forced to very quickly realign. And you could see out of just a desire for self-preservation, were they to face, you know, a very fierce European military power alone, they would know that they'd be defeated. But if they chose to ally with Russia and China, then they would probably do that just as a short-term strategy to survive. And the Bible does indicate that that's probably what will happen. So when we see Japan militarizing today, it is setting the stage for that Asian power bloc to be, you know, just to become a staggeringly powerful military force.
Where would you point people to for more information?
We have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now called "Japanese Military Seeking First Aircraft Carriers Since World War II." That's by Tyrell Shloda, I believe. And that puts this news about the retrofitted aircraft carriers into a broader context. And then we'll also have a link in our show notes to one of our trend articles called "Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism." And that one takes a deep dive into numerous Bible passages showing how this Japanese remilitarization is fulfilling Bible prophecy.
Okay, thanks very much, Jeremiah. We're going to finish the program with a couple of stories about crime. The first is from Germany, where violent crime has been increasing. A recent report had an alarming revelation about this, one that's sure to cause quite a lot of consternation among Germans. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this report looked at the level of crime in just one state in Germany, Lower Saxony, to try and give a picture of or a representation of what's happening across the whole country. It was commissioned by the German Family Ministry, and it found that there had been a 10.4% increase in reported violent crimes, and that 92.1% of those crimes were attributed to migrants. So basically, you're seeing an increase, a 10% increase in migrant crime. That's a big deal, and that it is migrants that are responsible. Now, it did include the disclaimer that this is an increase in reported crime. So the most obvious explanation is that migrants are causing high crime. They did point out it's also possible that it's just people are more likely to report crime by migrants. But that's not what people are going to take away from this report. Right. And I don't think that's exactly what's happening. It's a concrete link between migration and high crime. And this has always been at the center of the migrant crisis in Germany, mm-hmm. and people's response to migrants. I think, you know, the people that have objected to it generally do it because, you know, they're worried about their wives and daughters. They want the country to be safe. And people who have been more in favor of migrants have kind of said, well, that's just a perception. It's not really true. There's not really much proof to back up this idea that migrants are behind crime. It's being blown up by the media. And so this study provides probably the most comprehensive and concrete study into rising crime. And it does answer those questions. It says, yes, there is migrant crime. And yes, we can be pretty sure that it's this mass migration that has caused it. So that's just going to make life right. much more difficult now for Angela Merkel.
Right. Drop this report into the current climate in mm-hmm. Germany. And we've already seen political fallout from exactly this type of thinking, even if it was unverified and even if the media were trying to downplay the threat. For a government report to establish this link, you know that people are going to seize on this, and it is going to have even larger political ramifications.
That's right. I mean, you've got the CSU, the Christian Social Union, Angela Merkel's sister party, having a major party conference just right now. And they invited Viktor Orban to come and speak, who's been very critical of Angela Merkel. And you can see this, you know, driving a wedge between them, even, you know, making the CSU much more right wing in terms of the migrant crisis and not wanting migrants because they've got to defend themselves. I mean, it does. It affects the whole political system. And so in Germany, a lot of the dysfunction you see in the political system, a lot of the reason why they've set a new record for their longest time without a government, comes from the anger that exists because of the migration crisis. And so reports like this are just going to extend that anger. They're going to push more and more reasonable people who are far from being racist or anything like that over to parties like the AfD because of legitimate concerns like crime. And it is just going to help transform Germany. And for more on how that can help transform Germany and what the Bible prophesies that this will help do for Germany, you can read our article Germany Migrants and the Big Lie from the March 2016 print edition, and that will go through in much more detail and talk about just exactly how this is a political transformation for Germany, and more importantly how all of this is prophesied, because the Bible has very specific prophecies about developments in German politics over the next few months. And so by getting the background in those prophecies, as you watch Germany over the next few months, you can see Bible prophecy be fulfilled and be proven true.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks for that, Richard. Finally, a similar story about rising crime in Baltimore, but based on biblical prophecy, this one's likely to have a very different outcome. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, now that we're into the new year, cities and counties and states across the country are tabulating the crime effect for 2017. And Baltimore's numbers are already in, and it's actually set a new city record. They had 343 people murdered. That's about 8% more than last year, and actually even higher than the year back in 2014 when Freddie Gray, a black man, was killed by police officers. I guess the typical story is that it was a black man killed by white police officers, but that wasn't exactly true. There was three people involved in the incident there of both white and black race. But anyway, that's we had an interview that was published by NPR this week by a Baltimore pastor, Kinji Scott, a black pastor who was explaining that, in his view, this murder rate is just due to the fact that the police have pulled back so much from the public backlash against police when Freddie Gray was killed, which is exactly what has been said in Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's Great Again booklet on the chapter on race riots, is that the police in Baltimore have pulled back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's just allowed this this horrific rise in crime in the couple years since then.
So this has been something that a lot of conservatives have been talking about, the Ferguson effect. This is coming from a voice that's maybe a little bit outside of the normal who you would expect to make this point, but the point stands, doesn't it?
Yeah, the point definitely stands, and you've gotten quite a bit of data coming in even both ways, is that we know after like the Ferguson effect with Michael Brown and then Freddie Gray during the last term of President Barack Obama's administration, crime in the cities just skyrocketed. And now that President Trump's been a little more supportive of police officers, crime in a lot of cities has taken maybe a half step in a good direction this year. Baltimore got worse, but Chicago, New York, and Washington all got a little better. They still have high crime rates, but they're about 16% better since the Trump administration has taken over. And there are a lot of people who are attributing to the fact that the police have been more proactive since then at keeping a lid on some of that crime. And so that is just kind of verification of that point from the Great Again booklet about police pulling back, causing more crime.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess not to sound too pessimistic, but this is, it's definitely not, when you look at the bigger trends, you see that of the 50 most deadly cities in the world, two are in South Africa, four are in the United States, and the rest are in Latin America.
Mm.
And that trend's not going anywhere anytime soon. In some ways, you look at crime rates around the world, and they're generally lowest in Europe and highest in Latin America. But then the United States is kind of a strange situation to where we have European levels of crime overall, except for our big cities, which have Latin American levels of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit, New Orleans, St. Louis, and Baltimore are the ones that the homicide rate makes the top 50 list. Chicago gets a lot of publicity, too, even though its rate is lower. It's just such a big city that the total death toll is huge, with, like, I think 650 people killed last year. The prophetic angle for getting into this, and this is also brought out in the Great Again booklet, as it's interesting, is that in Isaiah 1 and verse 7, God prophesies that if the end time descendants of the ancient Israelites or America turns away from his law, your cities will be burned with fire, strangers will devour it. And so the crime rate, it's specifically linked to the urban areas. Mm-hmm. And as I was describing earlier, like says, as general, and you'll hear a lot of liberals try to tout these statistics, is that crime in the United States has been going down for several decades. It's upticked a little bit just in the last year or two. But that's in general. The crime in the cities is getting worse, as you're really seeing this huge divergence between murder rates going way down in rural and suburban areas and way up in the big cities. And that is exactly what is prophesied in Isaiah. And as is explained in this Great Again booklet, and I guess the other major booklet we have that really talks about that is the Ezekiel End Time Prophet booklet, where that one even explicitly mentions that when you look at the broad range of Bible prophecy for end time America, that mostly it's the cities that will have the race riots and the looting and the rioting because of the moral decay. And then the country areas will be spared from a lot of that until later on when there's a military defeat.
Mm. We have very important prophecies to keep our eyes on as we're watching these trends unfold within our cities in particular. Thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's going to do it for today's Trumpet Hour.
visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. You can get links to all the articles and the literature that we talked about on today's program. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, and Richard Palmer.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with these words from Leo Tolstoy. There are two kinds of people. One use their reason to learn what is good and what is bad, and they act according to that knowledge. The other act as they want to, and then use their reason to prove that that which they did was good and that which they didn't do was bad. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.